Robert J. Cunningham, Jr., Mary W. Tucker, Jasmine G. Talastory, Appellant Counsel, William E. Atwell, Appellate Counsel.
You may proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Robert Cunningham. I represent five couples out of six lot owners in the Saddle Ridge community, collectively known as the Shepherd Parties. This is on appeal from Clark County Circuit Court involving the interpretation of a declaration recorded for this community in 1988, and with the additional issue as to whether this declaration falls within the purview of the Virginia Property Owners Association Act. We believe the trial court erred in its rulings, which were rulings of pure law, and I believe the standard of review for this court is de novo review. I would like to turn to probably the easiest issue first, in my view. That's assignment of error number three. Assignment of error number three is directed to the amendment process set forth in the declaration. We believe that the amendment provision in paragraph 27 of the declaration is clear. And I also believe the trial court thought that provision was clear as well. Now, I'll explain what the trial court went on the tangent and went on in ruling as it did.
Counsel, while you're on paragraph 27, if indeed the amendment provision is clear, it's the only provision of paragraph 27 that's clear. And I'd like for you to, at some point, tell us why that 25-year provision is in there. You don't have to do so right at this second, but give us your thoughts at some point.
It weaves into my argument, because if you look at paragraph 27, which is the last paragraph in this declaration, it's merely a grammatical exercise. This provision states as follows. These covenants are to run with the land and shall be binding on all parties and all persons claiming under them, and must be in full force and effect for a period of not less than 25 years from the date of recordation, and shall automatically be extended for successive 25-year periods. This paragraph is talking about these covenants. Very simple. That's the subject matter of the paragraph. It further states, changes cannot be made unless passed by a vote of two-thirds of the then record owners of the lots in the subdivision.
But the question is, what are these quarter-century increments?
Well, it appears that unless they terminate the covenants by agreement in two-thirds vote, they will continue for 25 year successive terms. That's the only viable reading you can have in this provision.
Why?
Because there's no other verbiage.
No, why is it there in the first place?
We don't know. We're the drafters of this. We know that the intent was to have these covenants to be in perpetuity for 25-year terms unless, by two-thirds vote, landowners decide to terminate the covenants, which they have the ability to do, per the last sentence of that paragraph. We don't know why they're there, but they're there. We're in Sully Station territory. This is a contract between the parties. You are to read these, trying to view common sense reading and interpretation of these terms, and I think that's the interpretation.
But if there's any ambiguity, that cuts against you, right? Not asking you to concede there is, but if the court finds there is, these are strictly construed, et cetera, et cetera.
I don't think the contract terms are strictly construed because we are now in contract law under the prevailing case law we cited in our brief. In particular, we cite you to the Ross versus Craw case, Barrett versus Keswick Holmes, Ames versus National Bank, which are all stand for the proposition that these are interpreted as any contract would be. I believe it's the covenants, when you're dealing with restrictive on land,
right,
that concept applies.
Your position is also that just because something broad doesn't mean it's ambiguous.
Right. So the trial court, in its letter opinion that ends up in its final order, said two-thirds vote is required to amend the covenants. So the trial court made that finding. But the trial court says because it doesn't say what changes can be made, how the changes can be made, what are any restrictions, the trial court said, in those circumstances, it requires unanimity. And I argue before this court that the only restriction
If that were true, every change order clause in 1,000 contracts that are being worked on today are inexcusably indefinite.
This is true.
Because none of them say anything more than, here's the way you change this contract.
Right. Again, we're in contract territory. So the judge, because he thought that there was a lack of direction and specificity in the amendment process, he said, you know what, everybody has to agree to change these covenants. But the law is simply this, and I cite to a case from Judge Ledbetter in Spotsylvania County. An amendment to a covenant of this type can only be challenged by a court if it is unreasonable. There are cases we have cited for that proposition, and nowhere below did the appellees challenge the amendments to these covenants as being unreasonable, and they are, in point of fact, not unreasonable. You can determine that as a matter of law. So we believe the trial court erred in ruling that unanimity was required to amend these covenants if the covenants were properly amended.
Well, are you going to somehow weave that into assignment of error one? Is that why you picked three first?
Well, I thought three was the simplest and most concise and dealing with a very discrete issue. I'd like to turn to the thorny issue of Dogwood 1 and 2, as they're known colloquially, because that's the issue that I believe this court needs to revisit.
It's been in effect for over 20 years.
It has. It has indeed. And if you, when we look at this case and argue the case before the trial judge focused on Dogwood 1 and 2 in ruling that these declarations and these covenants were not within the purview of the POAA. And we believe that is a misreading of the statutory scheme that gives rise to the analysis in this case. We further believe...
But if you win on three, that's it, right? I mean, we don't have to reach any of that? Or do they do... Because we would then look to the amended...
Correct. I would agree with that point.
Okay.
Well, so, no, you can agree with that point, because if the 1988 declaration is invalid, everything falls, including the later amendments. But you don't have to say no to that. I expect you to say no. Let me get you before you run out of time. Dogwood is the problem in this case. But my question is, I see the holding of Dogwood as simply saying articles of incorporation and bylaws aren't declarations, period. So the mix-up between the conjunctive and the disjunctive, which is clearly there, is part of the background dicta of the case, but it's not the holding. In other words, there was no holding that said the reason why articles of incorporation and bylaws are not sufficient for declarations is because they did one of these two things but not the other.
I agree. The Dogwood 2 case did turn on that issue. That was a factually different issue than what we have here.
Well, that's important, because if you mean by turning, it's a holding, then if we don't need to reverse Dogwood, we just carve out the dicta that's inapplicable to our case.
That's one option. Yes, I agree. But again, if you look at the plain reading of the statute, the Dogwood cases state in very broad terms that in order for a declaration to be within the purview of the POAA, it must impose upon an association the duty to maintain common elements and to impose assessments.
May I interrupt you again? I wonder if the bar has been overreading that, because the way 55509 works is the association does have to make things happen, and they can either do it one or two ways. They can either do it themselves and then get reimbursement through the fees, or because of the disjunctive you point out, they don't have to do it themselves. They hire somebody to do it. So they'll make it happen. They have to make it happen, but they're not going to go out and do it themselves. All they have to do is have the power to force the lot owners to pay fees, which they hire someone to do it. Isn't that the way to understand the disjunctive in 509?
Well, Judge, I would advise that with respect to Dogwood, it has caused much consternation in this practice area, because practitioners view Dogwood as being in derogation of the statute 55509 because of the disjunctive. And in this case, we concede that the declaration does not impose upon the association, which is the ACC, which are all the lot members, the duty to maintain and collect assessments.
Can I interrupt you there? But it presupposes the duty, because the give me your fees is for doing something. It's not for taking trips to Vegas. It's for fixing the road. So it's I wonder if you're giving away your case a little bit, because... Does it need to say, I'm an association, I'm going to make sure this road is maintained? Why is it enough to say, well of course the road's got to be maintained, and all the lot owners are going to pay for it? Doesn't it presuppose the duty?
Yes, and in fact, we argued before the trial court that the declaration as drawn doesn't impose that duty, because it imposes a duty upon the ACC to enforce the covenants, which included the obligation for road maintenance. It imposes upon the ACC the ability to enforce the non-payment through the assessment of lien. So if we accept Dogwood for what it is, as I've argued in my brief, then I believe this declaration does fall in Dogwood.
So there's really two approaches from your perspective. One
right.
is Dogwood, the disjunctive is clearly wrong. The conjunctive is clearly wrong. Disjunctive is clearly right. The statements in Dogwood were not pertinent to the holding, so they were dicta. We can carve it out. Or two, all right, if we're stuck with that and you all won't reconsider the dicta, then the presupposition of the duty is the same thing as the imposition of the duty.
Yes, sir.
Counsel, this colloquy is quite interesting, but you're starting to run out of time, and there's an important matter in assignment of error 2 that I'd like to reach. And what I want to do is ask the question and not take up too much of your time. You can answer it on rebuttal if you'd like.
Very good.
Okay. In order to come within the Property Owners Act, there has to be common area.
Right.
In Manchester Oaks, we indicated that in order to be common area, there has to be equality of use, that everybody within the subdivision or within the division must be able to use the common area. In this instance, the record before us only shows that 4 out of the 6 deeds indicate an ability to use the road. The joint appendix citations are between pages 360 and page 385, and I don't see where the Condies are able to use the road based upon the record before us. Or I also don't see where the owner of Lot 1, which fronts on 605, is able to use it. And right now, that would be Emmerich. So Emmerich and Condi, the record doesn't indicate an ability to use it. You don't have to respond right now, but if you would respond either now or on rebuttal.
I can respond briefly now. The declaration reported in 1988 refers to the plat and deed of subdivision for this property.
Yes.
The plat and deed of subdivision in this declaration is in the chain of title of all the lots. The roadway is referenced in the deed of dedication. It's referenced in the declaration, and therefore services all lots.
But the plat doesn't indicate that every single lot has the right to use the road. That's the hang-up.
Well, to that end, all property owners to access their property in the community have to use that one common roadway to get to their property. That is borne out by the practices over the years and the actual conditions in the field. So this is a common element that serves the community because it has to, and is referred to in the declaration.
Okay.
Let me touch on one other point as my time's running out. Dogwood 1, I believe, refers to the notion that an association can impose fixed or variable assessments. The trial court took issue with the fact that the assessments that could be imposed by the ACC were not fixed, were not defined, were not in a defined amount, were not periodic. And surprisingly, no court in the Commonwealth has defined what a variable assessment is. This case presents the opportunity for the court to do so because we have a common paved roadway that may require maintenance every 5 years, 10 years, 12 years, but it's not fixed, it's not regular, it's not a common periodic thing. So this case presents the opportunity for the court to say, here is an example of a variable assessment authorized by Dogwood, and I believe it's appropriate to do so. Unless the court has questions, we can reserve rebuttal.
One quick question.
Yes, sir.
Your concern about Dogwood presumably would be taken care of if the court backed off the duty imposed being expressly stated as opposed to being inferred or implied. Am I right?
If you back off Dogwood to make it comport with Virginia Code Section 55509, which has that disjunctive, either the duty or the authority to maintain or impose assessments.
The conjunctive remained, it still would be, it would satisfy your interest that the duty could be implicit as opposed to express.
I would concede that.
All right.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is William Ashwell. I represent the appellees in this case, the sole lot owner that is not represented by the Shepherd parties in this particular matter. I think I was prepared for my part of this oral argument to focus mostly on the Property Owners Association Act and the applicability of that act on this particular Saddle Ridge Association. But I think more importantly, the focus for me is, does the declaration that we're dealing with in this particular case actually create a homeowners association at all that would fall under the purview of the Property Owners Association Act? Mr. Cunningham of the RIT panel was very straightforward with this panel. I believe Justice McCullough and Justice Power on that. He said essentially, I think Dogwood's wrong, and I want you guys to revisit that. And I think based on the facts that are in this case and also the good standing of the law applied to the statute 55509 is absolutely not incorrect and bears no reasoning why we look back into Dogwood to go into that any further.
Except for the over-reading of Dogwood 2 has a conjunctive test, and the statute quite literally says either one or two.
Correct.
Which cannot be interpreted literally to be a conjunctive test.
Correct, Judge. And I think even if we are to accept what Dogwood 2 set out as far as the declaration creating a homeowners association, giving it the powers that apply under the HOAA, I think under the circumstances, what I'm most surprised kind of from the appellant's initial argument is, looking at the actual facts of the covenant in this case, I think they fail out of hand reading the plain covenants from 1988. Unfortunately, clearly, Mr. Cunningham and I didn't have any hand in these particular, I think, builder-generated covenants, so to speak, which unfortunately caused a great deal of issues in this area of the law. But that being the case, I think what was kind of striking to me is the appellant's beginning with Simon 3 related to modification. I think under the circumstances, I couldn't disagree more with that having any sort of clarity whatsoever. And in fact, the court addressed kind of a similar covenant in Lake Arrowhead case. That case, again, I'm not sure why, created 10-year running covenants to be renewed upon a two-thirds vote. I don't know what the logic is in that.
Well,
what that is, I think...
We're not so much concerned about the logic of it or the wisdom of it, I don't think. We're concerned about the clarity of it.
And I'm concerned as well, Judge. Here's what I think...
Well, but what I'm suggesting is that because it's broad doesn't mean that it's ambiguous.
Absolutely. And I think here's the reason why. Is because when it's read, the paragraph 27 in particular, I think the changes that the appellants want to focus on in pointing to the ability for a two-thirds vote to amend the entire covenants and individual paragraphs, it says changes cannot be made unless passed by a vote of two-thirds of the then record owners of the lots in the subdivision. So why would the then record owners be necessary at all if a simple two-thirds vote is required to make any changes? The then record owners reflects to those 25-year periods. If there's a then record owner in that 25 years, whoever owns it then, they can relook at it and say, do we want to keep these things going or not? And I would surmise that that is what this change refers to, then record owner.
But the then or not then is not the disputed issue in the case. The only question in this case is, what is the supermajority rule? Is it two-thirds? Is it three-quarters? Is it 51%? Or in your argument, is it unanimous?
In this case, Judge, I think what the circumstances are is that there is not any true supermajority test. I think we default in these covenants to a unanimous decision to alter or amend.
But
this particular,
you know, there's a lot about paragraph 27 that doesn't make sense, but that makes even less sense. That it would only take two-thirds of the owners to terminate it entirely, but it takes 100% of the owners to amend it.
I think what this, and again, I can only surmise and guess what the point was in 1988, but I can
surmise ambiguity. I can't surmise absurdity. Why would it take two-thirds to terminate and unanimity to amend?
I think based on the situation, there's several reasons. If the initial declaration was chosen to have these 25-year periods to be able to revisit the issue, I think it's a simple way to continue in those covenants versus, as you say, seeking to have 100% of agreement. But I think we default, based on the way that these covenants are drafted, that in order to change the covenants that we have before us from 1988, there still has to be that pending 100% related to the amendment of those covenants.
Counsel, let me ask one additional question that's right in this line.
Yes, sir.
I used to do some of this work, and I'm glad I don't do it any longer. But I don't remember ever seeing a provision saying you can kill the covenants, that these covenants run with the land, and yet we will allow less than all of the owners, or even all of the owners, to completely eliminate the covenants. Now, implicitly, you can do so if you're not under a subdivision ordinance, because frankly, all of the owners can do whatever they want to do. But I've just never seen a provision that says it. Can you point me to any other cases where we had a provision that said specifically, right, you can kill these covenants?
Lake Arrowhead, Judge. Okay. I think, for Your Honor, under those circumstances, what I think we're dealing with in that case particularly, the court ended up saying, you guys didn't actually renew the covenants to go a further 10 years, which led to a lapse period.
I can see a lapse, yeah, but an affirmative... Go ahead.
Well, Your Honor, I think under the circumstances, I think the appellants want to use this two-thirds ability to say, well, we need to cure the obvious issues related to the initial covenants in 1988. We can use this two-thirds in there to bootstrap the change to bring us in line with kind of the Dogwood 2 situation of how we're going to cure a lot of these drafting faults that led to our kind of issues related to what happened at trial. So, under the circumstances, these covenants, with Lake Arrowhead actually kind of being drafted around the same time as these covenants back in 1988, I think the ideas of those drafters at that time was, let's give these lot owners the opportunity to decide, are we going to continue, are we going to amend, are we going to get rid of these covenants, and as after we started this community. I don't think that stops anybody. And in fact, you know, footnote 5 is perfect in the situation in Lake Arrowhead to say, look, we know that sometimes when we have to read these covenants in a certain way that is going to kind of blow them up, so to speak, and get us all back to square one of just being fee simple lot owners in a community, it's going to just have to take kind of some cooperation without homeowner association or POAA enforcement. And that's unfortunately where we come to in a lot of these things. But
in the, we had a case in 2004, Barris versus Keswick Homes, and it was in there, it was cited Henning versus Maynard, which is 1994. And that case appears to stand for the proposition that absent any writing to the contrary, you have to have unanimous participation of everybody,
yes,
in order to modify a covenant. But it goes on to say that the default rule doesn't apply if the covenant itself provides for a mechanism where the parties or some of them may modify or terminate the restriction.
Yes, sir.
So if paragraph 27 is broad enough to apply to all the covenants, why isn't that something that limits the vote to two-thirds as opposed to 100%?
Your Honor, I want to be very clear. I am absolutely not of the position that paragraph 27 is ambiguous to apply to the other covenants in this agreement. We are of the position that that is read strictly in paragraph 27. And that was my point related to the then lot owners.
But I'm not sure you're following the Chief's question. If it only takes two, or Justice Mims' question, if it only takes two-thirds to say, look, we're not going to renew this, we're going to start all over, start from scratch. It only takes two-thirds to do that. How can it not be true that it only takes two-thirds to change something, which is, okay, we're going to change the pro-rata share to some other different kind of... It necessarily follows. It's an a fortiori argument. If you have two-thirds ability to cancel the covenants altogether, fail to renew, how is it you don't have two-thirds authority to change the existing covenant?
Your Honor, I think that there's multiple responses to that, but I think what's most clear is, one, is that rule kind of cited as the logical explanation for the two-thirds in this paragraph isn't expressly contained for any other edits, changes, amendments for the other covenants. I think it has to be read in isolation for number 27. I think the answer is what would be logical.
The subject of the first sentence, these covenants, mm-hmm, and the last sentence is changes to these covenants. So why wouldn't we read it to mean, I'm struggling, frankly, to see the ambiguity at all. These covenants, and if you want to change these covenants, you need two-thirds majority. Okay. I don't need to know where they meet at the pool area or go down to the YMCA and talk about it. I don't need details. All I need to know is what's the supermajority rule, two-thirds of the supermajority rule, done. Vote and make whatever changes you want.
I think in reading paragraph 27, it does begin, and these covenants will run with the land for a period of 25 years, limited to what is the duration going to be for these covenants. The paragraph reference for changes doesn't reference covenants. It says changes cannot be made unless passed. And I think based on the circumstances, we're talking about the subject of the time period for which these covenants are going to run. So to answer your question, Your Honor, this is what I think logically would happen.
Can I stop you for a second? So you're saying this is talking about changing the time periods?
Correct.
So that's all they can change in the declaration? It's not even about, it's not even about whether they're going to accept or extend them. It's about changing that number, 25.
Correct. Whether or not the 25 years is going to remain in effect or whether we're going to renew it for another 25. And again, it's almost analogous to
that's not what you're telling me. You're not saying that it's a vote as to whether or not to renew it for 25. It's a vote to determine whether or not the period should be 15 as opposed to 25.
Yes, sir.
5 as opposed to 25.
1 month to month.
So you can change that, but you can't change anything else in the declarations with a two-third vote.
Two-thirds vote is going to direct the amount of time these covenants are going to run with the land, similar to the Lake Arrowhead issue. That was the 10 years, two-thirds vote to change that 10 years, which ultimately the homeowners failed. This court said because they failed to file and vote on a renewal, file it with the land records, we had a period of lapse.
Counsel,
I think that is what we're talking about.
Counsel, I'm going to throw you a lifeline. You are an effective advocate. I'm a fierce advocate. You just spent 12 minutes on assignment of error 3, and I'm counting noses. You might not prevail on assignment of error 3. Don't know,
okay. But
you might want to move on to the
I'm just trying to answer the panel questions that they had under the circumstances. But I think the point from my brief related to this particular issue is whether or not this declaration creates a sufficient declaration to bring this alleged homeowners association in the purview of Property Owners Association Act. And I think what the appellants have advocated in their brief, and I think on briefly on argument, I think we've both spent probably too much time on assignment error 3, is related to how this court reads 55-509. My biggest I think when looking and analyzing this case is both in Dogwood 1 and Lake Arrowhead, this court got absolutely right the General Assembly's reading of the different requirements in 55-509 between development, property owners association, declaration, common area, and what's required for that.
So let me ask you this then. How is this absolutely right? I'm a judge, I'm reading a statute, and it says the rule is you got to have either, I'm quoting now, either one, dot, 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 still quoting, or two, dot, dot, dot. And I read that to say, no, you have to have both one and two. How is that a reasonable reading? If, in fact, Dogwood 2 did that, and that's my question, is whether it really did that. I think you all are overreading Dogwood 2.
I think I focus more on Lake Arrowhead and Dogwood 1 versus the Dogwood 2 related to the either-or analysis for retroactively whether or not an HOA will qualify under the Property Owners Association.
Then what's your position as to 55-509? Is it a conjunctive or a disjunctive test?
For the declaration?
I'm just asking about this one statute. For the declaration, 55-509, is it a conjunctive or disjunctive test? Because there are two prongs.
I think there are two prongs which both must be met.
So it's conjunctive?
Correct.
Even though it says either one or two?
For the declaration, I think the way that I read the analysis to answer the court's question is in order to qualify, you must, one, have the power to collect fixed variable costs, and you must have a corresponding duty imposed to maintain the common area.
Even though the statute says either one or two.
Well, Your Honor, I would argue that I don't think the statute expressly says that. I think it is the contrary, because I think under the circumstances, 55-509, you're reading four or five different definitions to get to this test that the court has kind of adduced from that. And I think
interesting question whether the statute says that or not, and I actually share Justice Kelsey's concern about the actual words of the statute, but Dogwood 1 and Dogwood 2 have been on the books for 20 years, and the General Assembly has not indicated that we were wrong.
And Your Honor, I've gone through the legislative history on this ad nauseum related to the 2002, 2003, 2008, 2011, 2015 amendments. And not a single one addressed the concerns about applicability of a homeowners association to fall under the purview to to make it easier, to clarify, to create a test, to create a bright line rule. What that tells me as a litigant, and again, depending on Dogwood 1, 2, and Lake Arrowhead in bringing suits of this nature related to the court's decisions is, the General Assembly is in agreement with the court's reading of those covenants in those cases and establishing this test. And I think what's interesting to me...
Or the General Assembly doesn't want to deal with homeowners associations.
I can't argue with that, Your Honor, but I think under the circumstances, what was interesting to me and what I think the appellant's point is, on page, I think, 361 in the joint appendix, then counsel, Ms. Tadros, for the appellant said, Judge, we'd like you to legislate from the bench in giving a liberal or implied reading into these covenants to make them work in our case. And they're asking to do the same thing here.
Lawyer didn't tell a judge that.
Sorry.
Did a lawyer say that to a judge in the covenant?
I think it was tongue-in-cheek, Your Honor, but I think it kind of rolls into what they're asking the court to do today. As the court has acknowledged, we've had three cases on the books for more than 20 years. General Assembly does a thing. And I think they're asking the court to legislate in fitting into their fact pattern, which, of course, we ask the court. Thank you.
Your time has expired.
In response to your concern, I know Ms. Tadros, and I know that statement would have been tongue-in-cheek knowing her. The court to legislate from the bench. I'd like to make a couple of points to address your concerns about the interpretation of paragraph 27. What cures your concerns is your holding in Ross v. Croft, which states as follows. Contract language will not be treated as meaningless where it can be given a reasonable meaning. Parties are not presumed to have included a provision of no effect. Paragraph 27 is simple. These covenants are binding the parties and run with the land. These covenants have 25-year successive terms. Changes to these covenants can be made by 2/3 vote. That's how you read it. No other reasonable interpretation. I also want to point out an error that permeates this case by repeated references to an unincorporated association as being the association. This association was never a corporation. It was always an unincorporated association. All the lot members were members of the ACC, which by law makes that ACC an associate or sub-association. So you have cured and addressed one of the prongs of the POIA. You have an association that has the obligation and or a right to maintain the roads, to impose assessments, and there's a common element. If you satisfy those three prongs, you're within the purview of the POIA. Unless the court has other questions, I ask the court to grant the relief request in their brief. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen, for very good arguments. The court will be in recess until 10:45, when we will resume the docket.
All rise.